the 1970s, Bill McCumber was convicted of killing two young adults in the desert of Arizona. His son, Ron, grew up believing his dad was a monster until several years ago when he got a call from a lawyer telling him,
"We think your father's innocent, and we're pretty sure your mom framed him."
At the time of the arrest, Bill and Carol McCumber's marriage was falling apart, and Carol was working at the local sheriff's office where she had access to the evidence in the murders.
"I don't have any doubt anymore that my mom did this."
"Did you frame your husband?"
"No, absolutely not."
Prosecutors finally agreed to a plea deal that set McCumber free.
Mr. McCumber, good luck to you, sir."
"Thank you, Your Honor. This case is nothing more than a set of victims from beginning to end. Victims of the family of the two that were killed, myself, my family."
"Even though you watch television and you see all the changes don't impact like they do when you walk down the street. I am totally awed by the technology. I'm not comfortable with the dress of our youth. They're sloppy. I'm not sure it should be allowed now because, to me, it delves into self-pride. I said the order of importance is truth, freedom, responsibility. You can have nothing else if you don't have truth."
Welcome back to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Happy Tuesday.
Today's episode, Justice Revisited, the Bill McCumber story. So, William McCumber was released from an Arizona prison in late 2012 after serving 37 years for a notorious double murder he insisted he never committed. He was free for less than a year, though, before he was put behind bars again in Colorado for sexually assaulting some young female relatives. Now, upon his 2012 release, Bill spoke about his decades behind bars as evidence of a justice system gone awry, and he gave many interviews in the weeks following his release as well, including one with Keith Morrison of NBC's Dateline. He also spoke in front of legal groups and at signings for a book, Manifest Justice, that was actually written about his case. So Bill McCumber was a model prisoner who claimed that his ex-wife framed him for the 1962 murders of a young couple in the Arizona desert. The Arizona Justice Project sought a new trial for him, and prosecutors said they didn't have enough evidence to retry the case. So McCumber was allowed to plead no contest to second-degree murder with a sentence of the time already served. Now Ron McCumber, Bill's youngest son, and the Arizona Justice Project maintain that Bill is innocent of the murders, despite his recent child sex abuse conviction. But many people, including Bill's older son, believe he is guilty. Does Bill McCumber's recent behavior reflect upon his guilt in the 1962 murders? We're going back to the time of the murders and the evidence that convicted him on this episode of True Crime Brewery, Justice Revisited. So Dick has brought along a beer, of course, from the Arizona area, and I'm just going to do a couple of five-star reviews. And also, Dick, I'm very excited we have a voicemail from one of our listeners that I'm going to play.
Well, I guess our plea worked, huh?
Yep, we got one anyway. So hopefully it's a trend that started.
Well, we got one. That's a start.
Sure, it is. So let's just do a couple five-star reviews. I have My Favorite Podcast by Podcast Over New Orleans. I subscribe to all of the true crime podcasts, but this is the one that makes me the happiest when I see a new episode drop. Perfect balance of info and personality. These two are the best. Thanks for creating such a great show. Well, Podcast Over New Orleans, welcome to the brewery.
All this praise is going to my head.
I was afraid that would happen.
I'm going to have to be more braggadocio or something.
Okay. And another one is, Let's Go to the Quiet End of the Bar by Mix Maria 28. Husband and wife team Jill and Dick provide their take on true crime cases over a glass of beer. Dick's beer reviews provide a welcome bit of frivolity before discussing some heavy and sad cases. I also enjoy when Dick, a pediatrician, gives additional insight to the cases with his medical knowledge. I also enjoy it when he does this because I learn something too. So, Mix Maria 28, welcome to the brewery.
See, this is all going to my head, I tell you.
Oh, well, I think that the voicemail puts you in your place, so hang on there a second.
Okay.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Rachel. I am a stay-at-home mom of three and love your podcast. The Erica Lynn Parsons case had me sobbing the entire way through. My husband and I are also foster parents, and we've had 55 kids come through our home, some for a few days, some for a year or more. I just wanted to thank you for the way that you handle these cases. You're not glib or blasé about them. All of these cases. You try to put yourselves in the shoes of the victim. I would love for my kids to have Dick as a pediatrician because he's compassionate and also knowledgeable. Although at first, Dick, I thought you were a jerk. And I wondered how Jill lived with you. But I like you now. I also wanted to tell anyone out there, if that Erica Lynn Parsons story just made you sick, I want to encourage you to maybe become a foster parent or think about it. There are so many kids out there just like her who need our help as a society. So thank you again. I get a little thrill every time I see a new episode drop. It's so exciting because I can stop vacuuming and start listening. Thanks again.
Rachel, that's a beautiful review. And I'm glad you figured out that I'm not a jerk. And I'd also have to say, 55 foster kids, wow. There's got to be a special place for people like you and your family.
I know, I really admire it. I mean, we adopt dogs, but that's nothing compared to taking on the responsibility of children.
Absolutely.
I really admire that.
So a toast to you, Rachel.
Yep. Let's open the beer to Rachel today.
Before we open the beer, let's talk about it.
Yeah, tell us about it.
So we were in Phoenix not too long ago for a family wedding. And the very first Arizona beer I had was one called Kilt Lifter, which is brewed by Four Peaks Brewing Company in Tempe. So Kilt Lifter is a Scottish ale. And we've had kind of a Scottish ale before, but let me just remind people that Scottish ales tend to be more malt forward. They go through a longer boil to get more caramelization. And this produces a deep copper to brown color and a much richer mouthfeel. They can be smoky on occasion. And we've talked about peat and beers and how that works. Anyway, Kilt Lifter is a dark amber color, little tiny tan head. It's got a great caramel aroma and taste with a hint of peat. It's a very drinkable, relaxing beer. Try it.
Okay. And what are we pouring it into?
We're just using a snifter again today.
Okay. True Crime Brewery snifter.
Well, what else do
we
have?
A little plug in there. Yep. Okay. All right. Let's open it up.
Let's do it.
Okay, Dickie, let's go down to the quiet end of the bar and talk about Justice Revisited.
We'll do that. We'll drink this nice beer. It looks pretty quiet so far down there. I don't see too many people. But, you know, I'm glad we're doing this kind of early because today is the first day of the World Series.
Oh, who's in the World Series?
So this is an amazing series for people that really like baseball. It's got the Chicago Cubs, who haven't won a World Series in over 100 years, and the Cleveland Indians, who haven't won in 68 years.
Whoa.
So these are, I think, the two longest years in tenure without a World Series title.
Of anybody?
So, of anybody.
Ever?
Ever.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's going to be very interesting. I'm glad we're going to finish this up before the raucous people get here.
Absolutely, we will. Let's get to it.
Okay, let's go.
Okay, now I would just like to begin our discussion with the victims, like we usually do, of the 1962 murders. So Joyce Sternberg and Tim McCullough, these were two young people, each 20 years old, who were engaged to be married. They met at their jobs at the local telephone company, and the night they were murdered, they'd had dinner with their family, they went out for milkshakes, and they pulled into a secluded area off of a desert road to be alone together and have some, I would imagine, romantic time.
I'm sure they were making out, right?
Probably.
Lover's Lane.
That was probably the plan. I don't know if they ever got to. But the next morning, as a school bus drove by, some kids pointed out that there were two bodies on the sand, and they pointed that out to the driver of the school bus. So that's how the murder was discovered that morning.
Right.
So that morning, it was a warm one. It was May 24th of 1962. Detective Jerry Hill and Sergeant Lester Jones were having breakfast at Heising's Coffee Shop in Scottsdale, Arizona. Now, they were both with the Sheriff's Department, Major Crimes Division. Morning was still breaking when the call came in, two dead bodies in the desert. The two men left the coffee shop, of course, and drove across town to the scene. Now, Tim McKillop was a lineman for the Mountain Bell Telephone Company. Joyce Sterenberg was an operator. Tim's white Impala had pulled north off of a dirt track east of Scottsdale and parked. Behind it was another set of tire tracks where a car had pulled up and then apparently had backed away. So the murder weapon was a .45 caliber. There were four shell casings found near the car. Each victim was shot twice in the head.
See, that almost sounds like an execution style killing, doesn't it?
It does. And the motive wasn't clear.
Yeah. I mean, these are just two kids that didn't have any enemies at all.
Right, not that anyone knew of. Yeah. Doesn't seem likely that anyone would want to kill them.
So maybe it was kind of a thrill kill?
Well, the police went through several things. They thought about, could it have been a rejected suitor? Could it have been someone who followed the couple in a case of road rage? Could it have just been random violence by a gang? You know, so investigators did develop a theory, and they went with the theory that it was a thrill kill perpetrated by a gang of violent thugs. And there was evidence that there were people with the killer when he pulled the trigger, so that also added to that scenario in their minds.
Sure. Like footprints or something?
Yeah.
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 And we know there's another car out there.
Yeah, there was a car that had pulled in behind them and then backed out, it seemed like.
Right.
Yeah. So Joyce and Tim, they were buried side by side by their families. And the families knew that the two would want that. But this was really horrific and such a shame, because instead of two families coming together for a wedding celebration, they had to share in a funeral of two very young people, you know, barely kids, really, barely into adulthood.
Yes.
Yeah. So in August of 1974, so that's 12 years later, Carol Kempfert McCumber, I have trouble with that name for some reason, who had worked for the sheriff's office for years, went and talked to the investigators there. And this is when things kind of broke open.
Yeah. Now, so what we're saying is that 12 years elapsed.
Yes.
From the time of the crime until Bill McCumber was investigated and arrested.
Absolutely, that's right.
And the interesting thing to me is that this coincides with the time that he and his wife separated.
Yeah, that's what made it interesting.
So the idea is that...
Or suspicious, I guess would be a better word.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, there's some ill will there, and she's going to come out with some evidence that he did it. At the same time, I guess you could say she knew for a long time and kept it a secret because they were married. And then once they divorced or were getting divorced, she said, well, fuck you, I'm going to spill the beans.
Could have been either way.
Yeah.
Either way, it doesn't look very good for her character as a human being.
No.
No.
So one of the things that initiated these events and to him getting arrested was that a window at the home of Bill and his children had been shot out.
Right, so they were separated and the kids were living with Bill, right?
Right. So Carol says that Bill shot the window and blamed her. Bill did these sorts of things, she told the police. He often carried his .45 pistol. And remember, the gun that was used in the murders was a .45. She said that every time she told him she was leaving him, he acted crazy. So she said one night they were lying in bed and he told her that he had killed the two kids from Mountain Bell Telephone. So this was kind of a marital bed confession instead of a deathbed confession. Again, this case had gone unsolved for 12 years. And the police department didn't look so good because they hadn't been able to solve the case. So in her description of Bill's story that he allegedly told her in bed that night matched the details of the evidence. She even suggested Bill's motive. He had a bad temper behind the wheel, and he could be terrifying driving around. So her theory is that it was a crime of opportunity. although I don't see, you know, they were parked up there, necking. When did they perform road rage on Bill?
Well, if that were the case, I think the theory is that he followed him right there and they pulled over.
Yeah.
That's another theory.
Okay.
We don't know that they pulled over there to make out or that they were alone there at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, the FBI examined four prints and never found a match. But there was one, the first print lifted, that had never been analyzed. So detectives lifted it from the chrome strip along the driver's side window, and because they were unable to determine if it was a finger or a palm print, it was just never sent to the FBI. So after Bill McCumber's interview, that first print was examined, and it matched his palm. It was as if he had rested his hand on the door while leaning into the window. Now, the other key evidence was the four shell casings found at the murder scene. So, after a semi-automatic weapon is fired, a series of small mechanisms push the spent casings out of the gun, clearing the chamber for the next shot. The process leaves a variety of marks on the brass casing. So, 5 days later, Bill McCumber was called into the station, and he was already known to deputies as a volunteer with the sheriff's search and rescue team. So when he came in, he didn't know what he was walking into, and investigators started asking him about the shot out the window at his house. And they questioned him and gave him a polygraph test. He failed the test. They told Bill that Carol's story had implicated him, and they showed him her written statement. Now, the transcript of Bill's interview shows that he admitted then to telling Carol he was responsible for killing Joyce Steerenberg and Tim McKillop. So deputies at the 1962 crime scene had collected 15 prints from the outside of the Impala. Some belonged to the victims, but the other ones were smudged and were not usable.
So he, let me just back up a little bit, he corroborated this confession he gave to his wife.
Yes, but I don't know if he actually said that he... I don't think he actually confessed to doing it. I think he confessed to telling her he did it.
Right.
Right. But they also said he failed the polygraph.
There's some nuance there, I guess.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, I said that to my wife, but I didn't really do it.
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the FBI crime lab examined the casings from the scene. So most of the marks were indistinct, but the ejector marks were a match. So marks on three of the four casings matched the ejector pin on McCumber's Ithaca 45 caliber gun.
Okay.
So it wasn't a complete match, I guess, in other words. Because I didn't really know how they did that. That's why I researched that a little bit to see how that worked.
So, but there was a match. Not a primary match, kind of a secondary match.
I guess so. I guess that's what you could call it. A partial match?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've got his palm print.
Yes,
the scene.
Right.
And we have him confessing to his ex-wife, or then-wife, that he did it.
Right, so it's not looking good for him.
And he failed the polygraph test.
Right.
That doesn't look good for old Bill.
No. Now, Carol never took the stand at trial, even though her story was the foundation of the case. And also, the judge gave clear instructions to the jury that that palm print was enough to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Bill McCumber was at the scene, so that didn't look good for him either. So on January 24th, 1975, the jury convicted him on both counts, and at that point he was given two life sentences. So after his conviction, Bill McCumber told the Arizona Central newspaper that he was innocent. And he also said, regardless of what happened in the courtroom, and regardless of the verdict, thank God that saying it doesn't make it so. So at this point, he's denying that he did it.
Right. As soon as he was convicted, he said, I didn't do it.
Yes.
Publicly.
Publicly. Of course, he did plead not guilty in the case as well.
Right. So this was appealed. The verdict was appealed, of course.
Right, right.
And the judge ruled that McCumber's defense had not had the opportunity to present its own ballistics expert to try to refute the statement about the casings coming from McCumber's gun. So he's granted a new trial, Ended up being retried in 1977 and convicted again. So I guess the ballistics expert for the defense couldn't prove a case.
Or disprove it.
Or disprove
as
it.
As the case may be, yeah.
So Carol took the three boys and moved away, settling in Washington State. Bill McCumber moved from one prison to another. He continued to maintain his innocence, even though if he had taken responsibility for the murders and shown remorse, he could have been free. Really?
Yeah, at some point.
Yeah, not
sooner
right away.
Than he was, yeah. No, he certainly would have spent time in prison.
Right. And he apparently was a model prisoner.
That's the interesting thing.
And inmates looked up to him. The younger prisoners referred to him as Pops. Kind of brings to mind the guy in Shawshank. What's his name? Brooks.
Oh, yeah. Brooks was here.
Yeah, the old guy that everyone looked up to and tucked under their wings and took care of him.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's McCumber.
Right.
Pops.
Right. Although, I'd have to say there are some people that do better in prison. And they can be decent people in prison and get a lot accomplished. It doesn't mean when they're out in the world that they're going to be successful.
Sure.
Some people do better in that kind of restricted environment.
Right.
Yeah.
But he was allowed to leave. I mean,
he
traveled. He did a lot of stuff. Right?
Yeah. 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 He formed a chapter of the JCs in prison. And through the JCs, he set up English and business classes for the inmates. They also opened a snack bar for visitors, and the proceeds went to charities like the Make-A-Wish Foundation and the Special Olympics. He was given permission over 200 times to work with the prison rodeo and leave the prison, travel with them. So that's remarkable for a murderer, right?
And doing this with minimal security.
Yes, yes.
I mean, it was almost like he was a civilian.
I think that after a while, he was trusted not to flee.
And he never did.
Nope, he didn't. So eventually, the news of his achievements made it to his son, Ron, and that was through his grandmother sending Ron news clippings and things about what his father had accomplished in prison.
Now, Ron was the youngest son.
Yes.
And all his boys have disowned him.
Yeah. Well, with the help of the mother, they were children, and the mother told them, you know, he's a bad guy, and they didn't have contact with him.
Well, okay.
Yeah. So I don't know if it was Ron's decision. He was a child, but yeah, he didn't have any contact with him.
None.
No. So Larry Hammond, a well-known defense attorney, was introduced to Bill through the prison warden. And Larry Hammond, along with Ron McCumber, and the Arizona Justice Project began to take another look at the 1962 murder case.
The Arizona Justice Project is like a lot of these innocence projects in the United States. It was started in January of 1998 by Mr. Hammond. And their mission is to identify credible evidence that may firmly establish actual innocence or to indicate that a significant injustice has occurred. So it's a little bit different from a lot of the programs because most of these programs will take only clients who purport to have been wrongfully convicted and can prove actual innocence. But the Arizona Justice Project will take on not just the innocent people, but where an injustice has occurred. And this little article I read about the Arizona Justice Project talked about the case of a 20-something-year-old guy that was arrested with a gram of cocaine, crack cocaine. And got 50 years in jail.
Wow.
So they took his case on.
Just because they thought he was overly punished?
Because that was an excessive punishment.
Yeah.
But they are quite busy. They get over 400 requests a year from inmates or people that have been convicted of things.
And who funds them?
They have grants and they have private donations. But they, you know, There's a big winnowing process here. So, like I said, there's over 400 cases a year that get presented. But of those, only 60 or so make it through the first round where they start getting reviewed by attorneys. So you've automatically taken away about 90% of the cases. 80-90%.
Yeah, yeah.
And then of those 60, fewer than 10 actually come to fruition. Once the lawyers have vetted them and decided that this is a case that we can work on or not.
Well, I think once they pick a case, it takes a lot of man hours.
Oh, it does.
It's a big investment to take on a case.
It is. But not, I mean, you'd think, okay, I'm innocent, I'm going to write to the Justice Project and take care of it. But the odds of you getting to the end point and being represented by them is pretty small.
Right, right. Well, let's go back to 1967. A man named Ernie Valenzuela met a couple in a downtown Phoenix bar, and the three drank until the bar closed. Then they went to the couple's house, and when the liquor ran out, they drove out into the night to get more. Then Valenzuela pulled a gun. He told the couple to get out of the car. So the husband and wife ran in different directions away from the car, and they hid in the dark. And then it was getting late, and as the sun began to rise, the woman thought that Valenzuela had left, so she crawled out of her hiding place and went back to the car. But Valenzuela was waiting for her. Now Valenzuela yelled for the man to come out, or he was going to kill the wife. And Valenzuela shot the man when he came out and put him in the trunk, but the man was still alive. And he drove around for a while before pulling the man from the trunk and shooting him again. And then he placed the man's dead body back in the trunk. Then he raped the man's wife, drove the woman home, let her out of the car, and fell asleep in her driveway. So obviously he had a fair amount of alcohol in his system. And that's where police found him that day.
With a dead body in the trunk.
Yes, in the driveway.
And a badly beaten up woman in the house.
Right, raped woman.
Yeah.
Now because he was a Pima, is that how you say it?
Pima Indian.
Yeah. And the crime happened on the Gila River Reservation. The case went to federal court. So Thomas O'Toole, he was just beginning his career as an attorney. He was working at the Federal Public Defender's Office. And he knew that Valenzuela was dangerous. He wasn't a big man. He was 5'9" and 150 pounds, but he frightened O'Toole. And O'Toole was signed to defend him. So as they talked, Valenzuela told O'Toole that he had committed other murders. And lo and behold, he included that he had killed a young couple in the desert in 1962. Now, O'Toole immediately recognized the case because it was a well-known case. And of course, he knew about it.
Right.
Yeah. So he had Valenzuela interviewed by a psychiatrist who used sodium pentothal, which is also known as truth serum. And Valenzuela's story remained consistent with that. But I wanted you to tell us a little bit what you know about sodium pentothal.
It won't take long.
Okay.
So sodium pentothal has been used, and still is sometimes used, as a truth serum because it weakens the resolve of the subject and makes them more compliant to pressure. So that's a key thing, I think.
Yeah.
So if you're being forcefully interrogated, you're going to be more amenable to that with the truth serum.
So it could make them maybe not more truthful, but more pliable and more suggested.
Right.
More open to suggestion.
The drug tends to make subjects more talkative and cooperative with interrogation. However, and this is a big however, the reliability of confessions made under sodium pentothal is questionable.
Okay.
So I guess you get what you pay for here.
So the article that I was reading about O'Toole, it seemed to indicate that if he maintained that story while he was under sodium pentothal, then that would mean it was more likely to be true. But you're saying not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
Maybe that's the opposite, actually.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, this revelation remained a secret. It was subject to attorney-client privilege. So Valenzuela pled guilty to the rape and murder, though, that happened on the reservation. And he was sentenced to 15 years in prison. He ended up taking his secret with him to the U.S. Penitentiary in Leavenworth, and he died there in a knife fight in 1973. So 9 months after that, O'Toole learned that Bill McCumber had been arrested in the 1962 murders. So he immediately went to the state bar's ethics panel, seeking permission to break attorney-client privilege.
Yeah, because the the death of the client doesn't end attorney-client privilege, right?
Right. We learned that in the Ann Miller case.
Right.
When her lover that committed suicide, his attorney wouldn't reveal what he had told him. Although eventually part of it did get released.
Eventually he was allowed to release part of it, right?
Part of it, right. But not the part...
Heavily redacted.
Yeah, not the part that pointed him out as a suspect, but the part that pointed Anne out
yes.
as the guilty one.
Right.
Yeah. So that's significant. And I don't know, is that a state-by-state thing, or is that federal law?
Well, I don't know that it's a federal law, but it's certainly pretty widespread.
Yeah, I thought so. But so he went to the state bar, and it really didn't matter because the judge that heard his account, he called it unreliable hearsay. So there was never a jury that heard O'Toole's story about Valenzuela's confession for the murders.
Yeah.
But then in 1999, O'Toole read a newspaper article, and he decided to pick up the phone. He was no longer a public defender. At this point, he had become a Superior Court judge. And O'Toole talked to Larry Hammond, the founder of the Arizona Justice Project, and talked to them because they would work to free wrongly convicted or unfairly sentenced people. So law students and the Justice Project investigators started pulling out old files and reviewing the trial evidence. Hammond saw right away that Carol was the key to the case against her husband, but he didn't see Carol as a frightened woman or as a reluctant witness as she tried to kind of portray herself. To him, her 1974 interview seemed almost planned out. Now, Carol had casually noted that her husband liked to reload ammunition for his .45, keeping casings to refill them with a new bullet and powder to fire them again. And the casings at the murder scene were reloads, which is the same thing as that, which she probably would have known.
Sure.
Right? So Carol told deputies she thought Bill's story had been made up, a ranting from a manipulative husband. But she seemed to repeatedly suggest that he was guilty. In her interview, Carol said she'd heard that the victim's purse had been rifled through, and she described to the deputies how her husband could have done that by leaning in through the driver's side window, you know, kind of implying that's where the palm print would come from, on the Impala.
Okay.
So at the time of the murders, it was unclear to investigators if the print on the driver's side door was a palm or a fingerprint, right?
Right.
They said they didn't know. And it remained in an evidence box in the sheriff's department. This was the same office where Carol was working as a secretary, and this stayed in there for years. And Carol had taken courses as well at the Glendale Community College on how to lift prints. So Hammond came to believe that Carol had lifted her husband's print and put it in the evidence box to frame him.
I don't know. I mean, that's a real stretch, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, stranger things have happened.
That's true, but...
Her timing was...
The timing is the suspicious thing, yeah.
Yeah.
But
why was the print not usable and then it was just a clear print of his 12 years later?
Right.
That's suspicious.
It is.
Yeah.
But why does it all of a sudden come out?
Because she went and talked to them.
Yeah.
And that's
after he confessed to her.
Right. Supposedly. And I'm not saying either way. I really don't know either way or have... I'm really not on either side here. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, I agree. I think we can sway either way on this.
Yeah. It's really not clear.
But so this print that was the perfect match at the trial years ago was unusable.
Yeah.
So something happened. Maybe it's just you're able to look at it better.
That's possible too, yeah. But no one has come out and said that.
Right. They don't want to say that. The Justice Project worked on this case for 10 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
A long time. So here he's been in prison for all these years, and he's in another 10.
Well, see, and that's what I mean. When they commit to do a case, it can take man hours. It can take years of man hours.
Right.
So they really have to believe in the case in order to take it, I would think.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Yeah.
So while they're questioning the ballistics evidence, they're investigating the Valenzuela case, They're looking at other possible witnesses. They're busy people working for Bill McCumber. 2009, he stood before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. Because he was sentenced under the law as it stood, he was not eligible for parole. For him to be free, he needed the board to recommend that the governor shorten or end his sentence. So Hammond presented his case for McCumber. In the clemency hearing, the first two members recommended his sentence be shortened so he could be paroled. The next recommended he be released on time served.
Yeah. So they all had different opinions, but they all kind of came to the same thing in the end, right?
Right. Fourth member was in favor of absolute discharge. The chairman said that he would take this board's unanimous, or what appeared to be unanimous, letter to the governor stating that there was substantial doubt that McCumber was guilty. Injustice had been done in his case. But the governor, Jan Brewer, rejected the clemency recommendation. And this is from a board that she handpicked. The implication was that she always would agree with whatever the board recommended because they were her people. But she didn't in this case. And then the interesting thing, after rejecting the recommendation of clemency, a month later she replaced the majority of the board members, saying it was time to bring a fresh perspective to the board.
So clearly there was a disagreement there. She didn't like what they came up with for some reason.
Obviously not.
Right.
So attorneys with the Arizona Justice Project filed a motion for post-conviction relief. Among the reasons cited were evolving science that cast doubt on the reliability of the palm print and ballistic evidence. Motion also said that under current rules, the jury would have heard about Valenzuela's multiple confessions.
So that would have changed things.
So.
Possibly.
Possibly.
Yeah. Now, understandably, McCumber's release was upsetting for the surviving family members of Joyce Steerenberg and Tim McKillop, who believed that the right man was in prison for these murders and should stay there and rot until death.
Right.
Now, Judy Michael, Joyce's sister, said she felt McCumber had several opportunities to make his case in court. I mean, after all, he'd had two trials, and he'd had two clemency hearings, so she thought he'd had enough chances already.
You could certainly say that.
Yeah, and she asked the judge, where is the justice for us? And now, John McCluskey, who's a cousin of Tim McKillop, he asked the judge if questions surrounding the evidence in the case were so unique that they merited such special attention. Judge Cohen replied that he didn't know the answer to that question, and he agreed with John McCluskey that he had a valid question there. There did seem to be an inordinate amount of attention and consideration given to Bill McCumber. There are a lot of people out there in prison that aren't getting this kind of consideration.
Right. Well, I think some of that goes back to what a nice prisoner he was.
True. Yeah.
You know? He never tried to do anything other than be a model prisoner.
Yeah.
So, I think that came into play.
Now, when he was released, Bill McCumber got into his son Ron's car and drove away. At a cousin's house in Apache Junction, he ate pizza, and he allowed himself one beer. It was his first drink in 38 years. The next night, he went to a Mexican restaurant in Midtown Phoenix, where he celebrated with the attorneys from the Justice Project and with his family. So then Bill ended up moving to Colorado to be with his son Ron and his family. Bill's son Steve, who I think was the middle child, just passed away in 2012 of an illness, and he'd never reconnected with his father. Now Bill's son Scott, the oldest of Bill's sons, had not spoken to Bill and had nothing positive to say about him.
Right.
But Bill was welcomed by Ron, and he spent time with Ron and Ron's adult grandchildren, James Atkinson, Sarah Espaza, and I probably said that name totally wrong, and Megan Jensen, and also with his great-granddaughters.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So according to Ron McCumber, his great-granddaughters had at first been really excited about Bill moving to Colorado to be with them. But after a few months, they told Ron they didn't want to be around Bill anymore. So this is when this happy story of getting out of prison goes bad.
Takes a very dark turn, doesn't it?
It does. So Ron McCumber confronted his father, and his father's responses made Ron feel the need to kick Bill out of his house. It was less than a year since his release from prison when Bill was arrested on 4 counts of sexual assault of a child. Each count was a Class 3 felony, punishable by a minimum of 4 years in prison. He was convicted and he was sentenced to 8 years. So Ron still says he believes his father was wrongfully convicted of the 1962 murders, but he believes he is guilty of the sex charges against the great-grandchildren.
Yeah, that's true. He does say that. And it just opens up a whole different thing. It's really conflicting to me.
Yeah.
You know? And here's this guy who purportedly is not guilty of the murders in 62, but there's something that drives him to molest little kids.
Yeah.
It makes me think that his character isn't all the way it should be.
Well, sure. Yeah. But I guess it doesn't make him a murderer, right?
No, I guess it still is a stretch to say, well, he's sexually assaulting kids, and that makes him a murderer. But it also makes me think that there's kind of smoke, there's fire type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does. I think it does make you less likely to believe that he's innocent. Whether that's valid or not, I don't know.
No, I think that's for sure. It makes you think that he could have actually committed the murders.
Yeah. Now, the ex-wife, Carol, her thoughts are that the girls shouldn't have been victims because he never should have been released and this wouldn't have happened.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, he should still be in prison.
But the Justice Project says it's fully possible for someone who's innocent of one crime to be guilty of another. And I don't know if you've read that article about the Justice Project, about how they're not in it to keep people in prison to keep them from committing crimes. They're in it to, how did they word that?
Well, they're in it to free the innocent.
Right.
And I know I was trying to find studies that looked at how successful they were. And the best I could come up with is that somewhere between 15% and 20% of people that are freed go on to commit a serious crime. Now, in another part, they said that a very small number. But I'm not sure 15% to 20% is a small number.
No. That's what, 1 or 2 out of 10?
Right.
You know, just to look at it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess you can look at it and say that the majority, vast majority of people that are freed from crimes that they really didn't commit continue to lead good lives.
Well, and then another way to look at it, would he have been a child molester if he'd never gone to prison? Is this something that happened to him from being a prisoner? Right? Could being in prison make you a criminal? I mean, that's certainly a point people would make, that being in prison can change a person.
Yeah, okay. I'll go with that. But I don't think being in prison makes you a child molester.
Well, or anything. I mean, if a person goes to prison and they didn't really commit a murder, but they go to prison and they're living among murderers. Let's forget the sex assault for now, because that's probably a whole different story.
Okay.
But let's say you go to prison for a violent crime and you didn't commit a violent crime. Well, your time in prison, you might be surrounded by violence. You might come out a violent person.
I could buy that.
Yeah.
But I don't think it translates from being a violent person into being a child abuser.
Probably not. But there was no history of that before he went to prison.
Not that we know of.
Well, no. No record of it anyway.
Right.
Right. I mean, there were other cases we read about of murderers that did get exonerated and went on to commit murders.
Went out and got into murders again. Yeah.
Right, right.
But those were very few, very sensational cases.
Oh, okay. So the ones that reoffended with murder, what percent was that? Do you know?
Those were tiny.
Oh.
Fewer than a percent.
Oh, okay.
But
so what are these serious crimes you're talking about? Well, they're not violent crimes?
It could be armed robbery.
Yeah.
Maybe rape.
That's bad.
But yeah, no, at least from the stuff I read, most people that were freed of wrongful murder don't murder again.
Okay.
If they had murdered to begin with. I shouldn't say again.
Well, if they're exonerated and freed, the idea is that they didn't commit murder.
I know. So, and most of them stay on the straight path.
Yeah. Are most of them elderly, though?
Different ages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I think you might be less likely to be violent once you're in your 70s. Like, this guy was 77 when he got out. But the whole thing with the great-granddaughters kind of blows me away, because I watched the interview with Keith Morrison before I knew about this, and it really kind of presented him as an all right guy. Like, he did all these great things in prison.
It sure did.
Yeah, and he even, when he got out, he even, I added it to our intro a little bit, that he even was kind of being judgmental on people and talking about his honor and how the truth was so important to him. And I added that to our intro because I thought it was kind of ironic how he's talking about how he doesn't approve of how people dress nowadays.
Right, these young people, I don't like the way they dress.
Yeah, it's a matter of character or something like that, he says. Yeah. And then it turns out that he's molested his great-granddaughter, so yikes.
Yikes.
Yikes, yeah. Huh. Okay, you got anything else to add?
Yeah, but I'm not going to say anything.
Why?
Well, it
involves... Is it stilted?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's about child abuse and child sexual abuse. I mean, that's the scum of the scum.
Yeah.
So I'll leave it at that.
Well, I think you can say that. I think we all agree on that. We don't like murderers either, though.
No, we don't.
No, we don't. So I do feel really sad for his son, Ron, who was so excited to have a father again and brings him into his home and then gets betrayed like that.
It must be terrible for his son.
Yeah. And he even said that he had, you know, obviously separated himself from his mother and his other brothers.
Right.
Didn't have a relationship with his one brother before he died because of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there were some things we read by the oldest son that said that Bill McCumber was just a crappy person from the beginning.
Yeah, he was just a no good shit.
Yeah, which, you know, you kind of have to listen to that because he's the older one. He knew more about him. He spent more time with him than Ron had.
Because
Ron was just a little boy when it happened. What was he, 9 or something?
Seven or something. Yeah,
maybe even 7.
He a little young. Kid.
Yeah. So the things that the oldest son said about him, you know, it makes you wonder. Maybe he wasn't such a great guy, but I wasn't really impressed with Carol either.
I'm a little more reserved about Carol.
Yeah. Well, some things we didn't bring up is the things that he accused Carol of. He said that Carol had had an affairs and was bringing policemen into the home and having affairs with them.
Right.
So he was kind of setting her up as really trashy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we don't know if that's true.
Yeah, but I looked at the interviews with her, and I felt more sympathy towards her.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I think she was truthful.
Now, what about the story he told her on the night of the murders? We didn't mention that. He came home. Well, he says it was a different night, but she says it was the very night of the murders that he came home covered in blood.
Right.
So what was his story that happened that night?
He had been set upon by carjackers or something. Or he stopped to help.
He stopped to help.
Stopped
people.
To help some people, and somebody came after him with a tire iron, and he clapped him in the nose, and there was blood all over the place.
Yeah, that's kind of hard to believe too.
Yeah.
How much blood do you get covered with from breaking somebody's nose? Most of it would go on them, you would think.
I guess you can spew a lot out, but still, that's a suspicious story.
I thought so, but the fact with her is, why didn't she mention it sooner?
I know.
That's what makes me suspicious, is that she waited and came out with it when they're in the middle of a nasty separation.
Yeah, well, it gets back to what we were talking about earlier. You could look at that two ways, that she did it out of spite because they were getting divorced, or now she kept it quiet while they were married, and when they get divorced, she's able to tell the truth.
Yeah, yeah. But if she made it up, that's very spiteful.
That's for sure.
Isn't it?
Yeah. But I think there's too many things to be making up.
You think so?
So I'm not sure that he's actually innocent of the murder that he was freed from.
He was freed, but he was never found not guilty. He took a plea for second-degree murder.
He had to take a plea.
That's right. So he never was cleared of it. His name was never cleared.
Right.
So what things do you think that is too many things? You said there's too many things that she would have had to make up. So what things are those?
Well, the gun, the casings.
Yeah.
And I don't think just taking fingerprint courses can make you an expert at lifting prints. So I'm going to give credence to the handprint, palm print on the door.
Okay.
And the casings. And then he confessed to her.
Yeah.
Which he said he did.
He did say that he did. That surprised me. That made me think he was guilty.
So I just think he could have been guilty.
I think he could have. But what would his motive have been? That's another thing. There was no robbery or rape. There was no assault. If there was a sexual assault against the woman, I would say, aha, now that he did the molestations, I'd say he was a sexual predator. But there was no rape of this woman, Joyce Sternberg. So what would be his motive to kill these two people? You think the road rage thing?
Possibly. Or maybe he's just a sociopath.
I don't know. I mean, okay, I guess. But that's kind of strange that you're just going to go out and kill two strangers one night. This other guy, Valenzuela, seems like a psychopath that might go out and do something like that.
Yeah. I mean,
more than Bill does.
It's sure true.
Yeah.
But we still have some things that make Bill the likely perpetrator.
Right.
Well, we won't know.
And I guess it's a moot point because he's in prison. He's got 8 years. He's 77. Not in great shape. He's got emphysema, some heart issues. So he's probably never going to be out of prison.
Probably not.
No. Okay. Well, thanks for having this talk with me. It was interesting. I appreciate your input on the sodium pentothal. That's interesting, because you always see that in the old movies.
The truth serum.
The truth serum. And as soon as they give it to him, they blurt out the truth. They can't lie.
Right.
But that's not really how it works.
No.
That would be too simple, too easy.
And you have to be careful. It's an anesthetic, right?
Yeah. It could be dangerous.
Quick-acting, short-duration anesthetic.
Well, that's why I think it would have to be done in a hospital, I would imagine, with emergency equipment.
Yeah, you got to titrate it. In fact, you know what the main use of it was?
No.
It's used in lethal injections.
Is it now?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It was the first drug given.
Okay.
Of three. So you give the sodium pentothal.
And what does that do for your...
knocks them out.
Puts them to sleep?
Then you give them a paralytic agent.
Right.
And then you inject them with potassium chloride that stops the heart. Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, but I've heard with those that they can feel the pain of their heart stopping because you're not really anesthetizing them from pain.
Right. Or it's too brief. It wears off.
Oh.
But anyway, they don't use it anymore. The company that makes it said they're not going to make it anymore because they didn't want it used in lethal injections.
Oh,
so,
good.
So there's...
Do you know what they use now?
Well, then they use propofol.
They use that.
Instead of sodium pentothal.
I don't know if they use propofol. They use succinylcholine for the paralytic.
Right.
But I'm not sure what they use. I know they use, potassium chloride to stop the heart. And they do a paralytic, but I don't know what the other drug is. But I've heard that it doesn't always work great. It's not peaceful like you might think.
No.
Which is strange.
If you give them too much, you kill them with that dose.
With what dose?
With the sedative.
Why not just do that then?
Well, because it might not work all the time.
Yeah, I just always wonder about that. I mean, with all the people dying of overdoses, why not just give them a big boost of heroin? I don't get it. Why they go into all these different drugs when you can OD someone pretty easily, it seems.
You can.
I think fentanyl overdose would be easy. We're starting to wander
far afield here.
Ah, you don't like to do that. I like to go afield a bit and explore.
Okay. But it is, when they're doing lethal injections, I wasn't aware that they still did them because I thought that once sodium pentothal got taken off the market, they stopped doing them.
Oh, no. I don't know if they've done any. I don't know about that, but they do still do it.
Propofol is the drug that supplanted sodium pentothal.
Oh, okay. Which is something they use all the time in anesthesia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But that's not what they use for euthanasia.
I don't have any idea what they use for euthanasia.
But they do that in Oregon. I saw a documentary about Oregon and the right to die.
Right.
And there's a medication that they drink.
And there's some European countries that do it too.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so the ways to support True Crime Brewery. Let's talk about those a little bit, if you don't mind. So our website, tigrabber.com. We have an area called Team Tigrabber Perks where you can subscribe as a member of Team Tigrabber for as little as $2 a month. There are three levels of support, and members get a gift and get to be a Team Tigrabber member, which we've been working on, we're going to have some episodes just for members. Hopefully by the holidays, we'll have one or two of those ready. ready. An easy and free way to support us is to go to tygrabber.com/Amazon and do your Christmas shopping, Hanukkah shopping, or just shopping for yourself there. And we get a little kickback on everything that's sold through our link. It's also easy if you're on our website to just click Shop at Amazon and support Tygrabber, or to click on some other links there that we have for Amazon gift cards, for the Amazon Audible Club, which is great for the Audible books. And also there is a free 1 month trial of Showtime you can get. And that's under our On True Crime movie link on our website. And if you try out Showtime for a month free, we get a couple bucks for having you do that through us. And even if you don't keep it, you just have the free month and quit, cancel it, we still get a little something. So that's free for both of us. So that's really cool. And the things on Showtime that are really cool to watch are Ray Donovan, Shameless, The Affair, and, Masters of Sex, of course. I guess that's about it, I'm going to say, for supporting us right now. But I want to thank everybody for listening to True Crime Brewery. I want to thank Rachel for her voicemail. Please keep sending those voicemails because we really like them. And 5-star reviews are great. They help us a lot, too. We're available on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play. You can also listen right on our website. And we'll have another episode coming up soon. So thanks for coming to the brewery.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Still on.